Testing, 1, 2, 3. This is Dan Austin at the home of Gabe Paul. The date is Tuesday, May the 11th, 1993. Mr. Paul lives in Tampa, Florida, and on the old timers part of the Board of Trustees of or Directors of the Baseball Hall of Fame. I'm sorry, you want to correct that?
No.
Okay.
No, the veterans.
This interview is for the archives of the Baseball Hall of Fame. And first of all, Mr. Paul, I'm glad to be back again and that you're feeling much better.
Thank you, and I'm glad you're feeling better.
I'm feeling wonderful. Okay. Gabe Paul, born 1910.
January 4th, 1910.
Okay, so you just celebrated your 83rd birthday.
83rd, yeah.
83. That's wonderful. May I call you Gabe?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. You've been called Mr. Cincinnati. If anybody knows about the Cincinnati Reds franchise, everybody points their finger to you. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure we'll spend a lot of time on that. Of course, you were with Cleveland, the Houston 45s, when they became a franchise, and then with the Yankees. But I thought there were a couple of developments that occurred this past week, and because your career has been as a baseball exec, that we could talk about that, because this week the baseball owners signed a joint venture, kind of a first time ever, with NBC and CBS that would run through 1999, I believe, the contract. And what it does is that it provides baseball with no upfront TV rights payment, the way the CBS TV contract did, but would create a separate company by selling advertising for all these game broadcasts. That's my understanding of this joint venture.
I don't think it's been approved yet by the owners.
That's right.
But it's coming up for a vote this coming week. Mm-hmm. But I'm confident that they will approve it. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, they should.
Now, that's quite a departure from all the TV and radio contracts that baseball has ever negotiated in the past.
Yes, it is. But I think it's very sound.
Because they weren't going to get the kind of money they got out of CBS.
Yes, but it's kind of a partnership arrangement.
You think they should have gone into partnership and made a third partner, the Baseball Players Union?
I don't think so.
No. They're kind of independent contractors, so they really should have no voice in it.
That's right. I think they've got enough to say now.
We got enough, okay. Well, let's take this joint venture. Last year, CBS sold about $150 million in advertising revenue for the broadcast. Let's say that next year, 1994, that this joint venture would sell another $151 million. That way, if it was a 50-50 split, baseball would get about $75.5 million of the revenue. And that's much less than the what they have been getting.
I don't know what the split is going to be.
Well, let's assume it would be a 50-50 split. Right now they get from CBS $265 million a year. That's going to be from $265 to $70.
I'm not going to assume anything.
You're not going to assume anything?
No.
Okay. Well, I was going to get you to see if you would think about if we had a 50-50 split or a 75-25 split. It's still going to be a lot less than what CBS has been paying Major League Baseball these past, well, since, what, 1990?
Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I don't know.
You don't know. Well, that would lead to me, since you won't speculate or make that assumption, that the baseball owners are going to say, we got to put an end to the wage war and these accelerated prices of the ball players.
I think they have felt that way for a long time.
They have, but a lot of them say they're going broke. But everybody wants to buy a franchise, and the prices double for them every 3 or 4 or 5 years.
This is the only business in the world where bad business sometimes is good business.
You mean for a tax write-off?
No. Tax write-off, that is the most misused statement of all.
Why?
There never is more than 100% tax write-off.
Can't have any more than that.
Never.
So are you telling me that the guys and women that buy baseball teams, that they could be successful in one business, but they forget good, sound business practices when they buy a team?
Yes. I think ego has a great deal to do with it.
They got the best toy in the world.
Right.
An unregulated monopoly. No foreign or domestic competition. They can get local governments to subsidize the facilities.
In some cases.
In some cases. Franchise price, you know, buy one, make 100% profit 5 years down the road. Do you think this has got to end someday and that...
Everything ends sometime.
And you think the day is coming that no more of all of this that makes up the business of baseball?
I don't know when. It's not a question that if, it's a question of when.
Not if, but when. Like another hurricane to hit Florida. It's not if, it's when.
Right.
Well, let me ask you this. About all these long-term contracts that the baseball, some of the superstars are getting. Bonilla of the Mets, Bobby Bonds of the Giants, they have just signed recently. Those multi-year contracts are based on if the club is solvent. If they don't have that kind of money, I don't see how they're going to be paid. And I would assume that much of the money that a club's going to get is from TV revenue.
Yes, but in most cases, the real good players earn what they're getting. The fellows that'll kill you are the mediocre players who, if you sign, you lose. And you don't want to pay big money to lose.
No, you're not in that business to lose.
No.
But I've seen a lot of big ball players, you know, that, you know, take Eric Davis off to the L.A. Dodgers, Daryl Strawberry. It goes on and on. I mean, those are your big names in baseball. Either they end up injured, or they bat below 200, these are not mediocre ball players. So just not the average or mediocre, this could be...
That's the history of the game. That has gone on since the first day of baseball.
Okay. Okay. Well, let's go back we had talked about this in our first interview. I recall that you were the ticket agent for the Rochester Redbirds in 1928.
The Rochester Red Wings. Yeah.
Red Wings. The old International League.
Yeah.
How'd you get that job? 16 years old?
18 years old. Ward Giles handed me some tickets and told me I want you to sell them.
Oh.
and that's how it happened.
Well, you just happened to be walking by downtown Rochester?
No. I had been hired as in the PR department. And for 6 weeks, and when I got back from speech training, he asked me if I wanted to continue. And the job he gave me was the handling of tickets.
So start selling tickets. Why don't you go down to the local Chamber of Commerce?
No. We had a downtown ticket office, and they put me to work there.
I mean, people walk in off the street and say, I want two tickets for the Red Wings game?
Yep.
And they gave you the money?
Yep.
And you gave them the ticket?
Yep.
Just like selling Bibles or knives and forks?
Yep.
Oh, okay. Well, that wasn't complicated.
No.
I guess you were pretty good at it.
See, I became a member of the Ticket Sellers Union.
The Ticket Sellers Union?
Yep.
Never heard of it.
And the instruction they gave me when I became a member of the union, now don't give them too much information.
And don't give who?
The people.
The fans.
The fans. So, and I'm standing there with plenty of time and in between sales, and I'm saying to myself, why shouldn't I give the information?
What kind of information?
Where the tickets are, and the location of them.
Oh, whether behind the third base dugout or in right field.
Yeah. And the best they got. And that just didn't make sense to me as a kid. And so, when the next customer came up, I answered all the questions. And they appreciated it. And I made in my mind from then on that was the thing to do.
Give the fan all the information.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you broke ground for something new.
I don't know whether it's new or not, but I don't know whether I broke ground or not, but that was my feeling.
Did you get the wrath and anger of the other ticket sellers after you?
No, but I remember when I became in charge of tickets, I actually tried to get the ticket sellers to follow my lead on that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty hard.
They were just going to resist you altogether.
They just didn't do it.
Well, weren't all the tickets, you know, row number 5, seat number 7, 8, and 9, weren't they printed in that way then?
Not necessarily.
No?
No.
So if you sold a general admission ticket, it was first come, first serve, or if you sold a box seat?
It was a definite location.
So any seat within the box seat area, first come, first serve?
No, box seats were specific seats.
Oh, okay.
But my feeling always has been, give the customer all the information you can possibly give them.
Don't pull any surprises on him.
Right. They're entitled to as much information as you can give them.
Warren Giles taught you that.
Yep.
So he was kind of your mentor when you went over to the Reds then, and later when, of course, he became National League president. Well, you did real well because Rochester won the International League pennant that year, didn't they?
They won 4 years in a row.
Who was their manager?
Billy Southworth, to start, and then Bill McKechnie.
Oh. Okay, and Billy Southworth went over to Boston, and Bill McKechnie went over to Cincinnati.
Bill South went back to St. Louis. And Bill McKechnie went back to St. Louis.
And then later went to Cincinnati.
Yeah.
In the late 30s. So you became head of ticket manager, 18 years old, got on a train, went to Kansas City in the Little World Series. Mm-hmm. Who won that World Series anyway?
Kansas City.
I thought they did. Kansas City Blues. Mm-hmm. Rochester, who owned that club? Or who was under what contract?
The Cardinals.
The Cardinals? This was the days before the old Gas House Gang, and were individual club, minor league clubs owned by one of the major leagues or just under yearly contracts?
Some were owned and some were not.
Okay. And in the case of Rochester?
They were owned 100% by the Cardinals.
Who was in the front office of the Cardinals in those days?
Brad Tricky.
Yes, I thought so. So I guess you had a chance to meet with Mr. Ricky on occasion.
Very much.
He teach anything about being a good baseball executive?
I enjoyed all the meetings with Mr. Ricky. You can't go away from being with Mr. Ricky without learning something.
Well, he was a shrewd judge of baseball talent.
And a great executive.
In what way?
Every way.
Well, he managed people.
Managed people.
You trust them?
Trust them. And he was just a good executive.
But he was shrewd and hard-nosed, too, wasn't it, when it comes to negotiating a contract?
Yeah, but he wasn't nearly as hard-nosed as they credited him with being.
Oh, part of the image,
mm-hmm.
which he probably loved.
Mm-hmm.
And Warren Giles, he was with you at Rochester?
I was with him.
Okay. I guess he gave you a few tips about becoming a future baseball exec.
Many, many tips. One of them was, don't ever break your word. Your word is the most important thing you have.
So if you promise, you better remember your promises.
Absolutely.
And don't promise too often.
Well, it goes without saying. Mm-hmm. If you make too many promises,
they could get confusing.
You're in trouble.
In those days, baseball owners and scouts, as I read about Judge Landis when he became commissioner, that a lot of baseball owners and execs would get young budding ball players, 18, 17 years old, to sign, should we say, letters of agreement rather than contracts. And of course, now this is the day when baseball club would own them forever, unless they traded them. He tried to crack down on that practice a lot during the 30s, if not before then.
He never was in favor of that. Landis was that. Mm-hmm. His position was if you have an agreement, use a standard form of contract which is provided for it.
Don't come up with another form.
That's right.
That has no legal standing.
Right.
But I'd heard that the Cleveland organization in the late 30s would give these pieces of paper called letters of agreement, and the kids wouldn't know. They think it was a contract when it wasn't. Kids would sign off.
That wasn't so really. maybe it was a conversation.
Okay. One of the C stories of baseball, then.
That's right.
That gets exaggerated as the years go by.
Yep.
Okay. Well, let's go. How'd you jump up then from Rochester to Cincinnati? I guess what, about 1934?
1936, October of 36. Giles went to Cincinnati as the president, and he asked me if I would go with him.
Now, why would you go to a club that was virtually bankrupt? Some fellow by the name of Crosley Powell.
They were not bankrupt at that time.
They weren't? I guess a couple of years earlier then.
Yeah.
When
that's how Mr. Crosley got involved in it. Mm-hmm.
He bought it from a group of bank or a bank or something.
The bank, yeah. He got the bank. It took the bank out when they were anxious to get from under them.
But he was a businessman, made ice boxes and cars and really probably didn't...
Radios.
Radio. Probably didn't know too much about baseball, per se. He owned a radio station.
He owned a 500,000-watt station.
Yeah.
WLW stood for World's Largest Wattage.
WLW?
Yep.
World's Largest Wattage?
Yep.
Where was it located?
Cincinnati.
Oh, right in on top of a hill.
Mm-hmm.
500,000 watts.
Yep.
Heard from Canada to Mexico, huh?
All over the Western Hemisphere.
And Cincinnati broadcast their games on WLW.
No, we broadcast them on WSAI, which was another station he owned. He owned two stations.
So
WLW did not broadcast the games.
Okay. Let's go back to Warren Giles bringing you along to Cincinnati. You came in as what? In what? Doing to do what job?
As PR man, and the following year. He made me the traveling secretary.
Okay, so you took care of the ball players' needs and things like that while they were on the road?
Yep.
And what did a PR man do in those days?
Not a whole lot.
Okay. There was no television. I guess you could talk to the local Chamber of Commerce about trying to get companies to buy box seats.
Well, you never got very far with the Chamber.
Yeah, we're in the middle of a depression, so...
That didn't make any difference.
No. Well, you had a president of Cincinnati. That was Warren Giles. Mm-hmm. You were PR man and traveling...
In effect, I was the assistant to Mr. Giles.
So anything that he wanted to get done, depending on what it was, he would say, Gabe, I need to have you do this.
That's right.
There was a general manager.
He was a general manager.
He was general manager. Did you have a director of player personnel?
No.
Nope. You have a farm system director?
Yep. Frank Lane.
Frank Lane?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my land. What a team. Leader of Cardinal organization.
Yeah.
I got to ask you something. Here you have president and general manager, one man for both jobs. You have a director of player personnel. Then you have a club manager, whoever that was, Cincinnati. Then you have a PR man, you. To me, as a kind of a neophyte looking in through the window of this organization, it seems like everybody get confused as to who does what.
never got your views.
Let's say Frank Lane said, hey, I want to trade. Hey, we got a ball club that is really terrible.
What do you call it? Warren Giles made all the decisions.
So if Frank Lane wanted to make some trades only with the blessing of Warren Giles.
He didn't make any trades. Giles made the trades.
So what did Frank Lane do?
Mostly the detail work.
Such as?
Player transfers.
Player transfers?
Yeah.
What's that mean?
Well, you're going from Durham to...
Oh, within the minor league system?
Yeah.
So he'd keep his eyeballs on the upcoming players?
Yeah.
Find which ones need to come up to a class AA ball,
yeah,
or go down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, apparently you must have picked up some of the knowledge of how to do that by listening to Mr. Giles and what he thought about these, how he made those trades, and because you later had to do a lot of that yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, he was very successful because he took a team at the bottom of the league, and within, what, 2 years?
2 years, yeah.
That it was in the World Series, what, for, yeah, what, two straight years?
Yeah.
Almost three. So what kind of trades did he do that to rebuild a club that quickly from last place to first place in a matter of 2 years?
The combination of development and trades.
And some of the best trades?
In my opinion, the best trade was when he got Lonnie Fry from Chicago. He was a shortstop at that time, and they made a second baseman of him. Mm-hmm. And he became an outstanding second baseman.
Lonnie Fry?
Lonnie Fry.
Mm-hmm.
And when he got Bucky Walters from the Phillies, Bucky Walters was a great pitcher.
Yes, he was.
Mm-hmm. And
what about Ernie Lombardi?
He was there.
He was already there?
Yeah.
I guess he came earlier from
yeah,
from the Dodgers.
Yeah.
How'd he get McCormick? Was he already there too?
Yeah. Billy Meyer, the shortstop, is already there.
Billy Meyer?
Yeah.
Who later became manager of the Pirates and the...
No, this was a shortstop.
Okay. Not a different Billy Meyer.
Different Billy Meyer.
Okay.
He was a great shortstop. Harry Kraft.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Outfielder.
Mm-hmm. Ivan Goodman.
Goodman?
Was there.
Was he a third baseman?
No, right fielder.
Right fielder. Well, who'd you give up for all that talent? If those were your best deals.
Well, most of them were there. And in the case of Fry, gave a mediocre player, and in the case of Walters, cash was the most important thing.
Okay. So nice to have Mr. Crosley bankroll this,
yeah,
and to build it on cash when a lot of clubs were hurting.
Yeah.
And then he hired Bill
McCagney.
McCagney. Who hired him?
jobs. He succeeded Chuck Dressen.
Oh, Chuck Dressen was the manager.
Yeah.
So, all of a sudden you had a pennant contender. Mm-hmm. With Red Barber at the microphone.
Yep.
And night baseball.
Yep.
And a ballpark called Crosley Field rather than Redlands Field.
Yep.
Not many baseball execs and owners have the privilege of, within such a short time, to see such a pennant contender, a building of that kind of team.
That's right.
What are three greatest memories you have about that collection of talent? Okay. Defense, pitching?
Pitching, yeah.
Well, you had pretty good hitting. Ivo Goodman, what, had 30 home runs in 1938?
And they had speed.
Frank McCormick had 128 RBIs in 1939.
He was a great player. And a great influence on the team.
Heard he was one of the most unselfish ball players that ever put on a uniform.
Great, great.
A gentleman as well as a fantastic athlete.
Yeah.
First baseman. What's some particular episode or incident that you think epitomizes Frank McCormick with yourself or with other ball players when you say he was a great influence on them?
Well, he just was a solid citizen.
A what?
Solid citizen.
Is there some particular incident, that episode that you remember, that, or story, taking a young ball player under wing and...
No. He was there whenever they wanted him. He was always available.
To do whatever...
Whatever they wanted.
If it meant bunting, even though you might want to go for it, he bunted.
You're right. He was an outstanding defensive player, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had Billy Werber.
Billy Werber was great.
Scored a lot of runs.
Yep. And Werber did a lot off the field, and he did a great deal to keep the fellas' morale up.
What, just pat him on the back and a hollower from the dugout?
He didn't pat him on the back. If somebody didn't do his best, he got after him.
Oh, kicked him in the butt.
Yep.
So he's kind of like an Enos Slaughter.
They were entirely different.
Oh. I was just thinking of the hustle and the drive. I don't know the impact that Slaughter had with other teammates, but you had Bucky Walters completing a phenomenal 31 games in 1939. Find a pitcher today that would pitch two complete games and make the headlines on the sports page. Of course, that's long before the days of specialization and relief pitchers and middle relievers and all that.
Bucky felt that if he didn't pitch a complete game, he did a lousy job.
Even if he won?
Yep.
Of course, a lot of baseball owners felt that that was a way to determine who got a raise the next year or not by the number of complete games.
Some did.
Yeah. And then, of course, you had Johnny Vandermeer.
Yep, just talked to him a couple hours ago.
How's he doing?
Great.
I heard his daughter passed away.
Yes, his daughter and his wife.
Yes, I knew his wife had passed away.
Yeah.
Both had cancer, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Just lives up the street here from you.
That far.
Along with Tony Cuccinello.
Cuccinello, yeah.
Did Vandermeer come up in the farm system of Cincinnati?
Yes. Well, he started the Brooklyn organization. And it wasn't until he got to Durham in 1936 that he blossomed. That was the year that he struck out 295 men. And I'll never forget, we were playing an exhibition game at Lynchburg, Virginia. And sitting next to Bill McKinley on the bench before the game, it's 1938, and Bill let out an exclamation. He said, he's got it, he's got it. That was the year pitching two no-hitters.
Oh, really? Did you see both of the no-hitters?
Yeah.
You did?
Mm-hmm.
When I interviewed Vandermeer, I asked him, I said, you had that special feeling? He said, no, it was just regular feeling. I didn't notice anything extraordinary. Of course, I'm sure he's been asked that question millions of times.
You know who made the last out?
I'm sorry?
You know who made the last out in the second no-hitter?
Mm-hmm.
Theodore Roosevelt.
Really?
With the bases loaded.
Recreate that. I know I was unaware of it. I didn't have any idea it got down to that kind
He had walked the bases loaded.
Well, he did walk a lot of guys.
And Ernie Coyne hit the ball to...
This was against Brooklyn.
Against Brooklyn at Ebbets Field. The first time he came at Ebbets Field. And Coyne hit the ball to the third baseman, and they forced the band to play it. And then DeRocher came up and hit a short fly to center field. Hmm. That was it.
That was it.
History was made.
Was it repeated before or since?
No.
You get a raise that next year?
How much? I don't know.
You were there for the first night game in Major League?
No, I was not there.
You were not there for that?
No, I was. That was before I came in Cincinnati.
I guess that was, what, 35 then?
I forget. I didn't get there till...
Yeah, 35 it was, the year before you came. Of course, there had been night baseball in the minor leagues for a number of years prior to that.
Yeah.
Was it kind of murky, a lot of shadows on the field in those early days of night baseball?
Yes, there were areas that the lights didn't penetrate.
Or get lost above the lights going in the outfield?
Not too much. In the minor leagues, more than the major league. The major league had a much better lighting system. At the start, they limited the night games to 7 a season per club.
Only 7 per season?
Mm-hmm.
Why'd they do that?
I don't know.
Then it spread really faster through the National League than it did in the American League, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was a way to entice people to come to the ballpark.
Yes. Hey. You know, Larry MacPhail is credited with being the father of night baseball. But what really happened is he talked to Crosley about it and said if we had night baseball, we would draw so many more people. And Crosley said, have we ever asked the league for permission? And Larry said, no, we haven't. And Crosley said, well, why don't we do it? That's when he asked the league for permission. Crosley had asked him to do it.
Was there any reluctance, resistance to say yes?
There was in some quarters, yes.
But given that it was tried in the minor leagues and this would supposedly help bring out the fans, why not?
Seven games was supposed to add another Sunday. Which it did.
The Reds went on to go into the World Series twice. What, once against the Yankees and once against the Tigers?
That's right.
How'd they do?
They got swept in against the Yankees, and they beat the Tigers in a seven-game series.
Was that 1940?
1940.
39, they played the Yankees.
Yeah.
One of the great teams of history, that particular win period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the last year that Lou Gehrig played? I don't remember if it was 38 or 39, his last year.
I
don't remember. That's all right, didn't make it.
I think that Gehrig played in the All-Star game in 1938, which was played in Cincinnati.
Oh.
And Joe McCarthy had great misgivings about his condition.
Of course, by that time they knew that he was...
There was something wrong. They didn't know what, but there was something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I know he hit a ball to right field. And McCarthy said that if he was all right, that ball would have been way out of here.
Mm-hmm.
But he was not all right.
So you were in charge of putting the public relations, all that together for the 39 All-Star game.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, let me see, that would have been the sixth year of the All-Star game.
Mm-hmm.
So you had Joe McCarthy managing the American League. Who managed the National League All-Stars? Remember right offhand? Okay. What kind of preparations? You didn't have to worry about television, so there was nothing really to really prepare for except put some red, white, and blue banners on the dugouts and say, come on out, folks.
And we have a press room. And I had to make a press arrangements.
Had it caught on big that there was a lot of baseball writers that would come by that time?
Oh, yeah, sure.
What do you remember about preparing for that All-Star game that you'd like to brag about?
Nothing.
Nothing? Oh, come on now. You can't be that modest.
No, I'm not modest either.
You just did your job and it went off well.
That's all.
So you took your bride to two World Series. I guess you had just married Mrs. Paul by that time?
Yep, and married her on the opening day of 1939.
She thought that all you did was win pennants and go to World Series.
That's right.
That was all. That's what baseball's all about.
Yep.
You didn't try to tell her anything other than that either, did you?
Mm-hmm.
How did you meet Mrs. Paul? In Cincinnati?
No, here in Tampa.
Oh, here in Tampa.
During spring training.
Oh, spring training. Okay. Where she worked for the ball club, or?
No. She was in a silent show. And Frank Mitchell is assistant manager of the Tampa Terrace Hotel. And I had the flu, and he brought a bunch of the people up to visit me at the Florida Hotel. And one of them was Mary, my wife.
Just swept her off her feet and
I didn't sweep her off her feet. She swept me.
Oh, okay. Well. That ball club of 39 and 40. You would think that everybody said, well, in 1941, the Reds are going to repeat for the third straight year. I mean, you had McCormick, you had Lombardi, you had fantastic pitching.
A lot of people thought so, but...
What happened?
The Dodgers came up.
That can't be just because the Dodgers came up.
Yeah.
I mean,
we just didn't do it, that's all.
Pitching or hitting?
Both.
What about McCormick and Lombardi? Did their batting just kind of went kaplop?
No. I don't think it was their fault.
No, I'm trying to say their fault, but you know, everyone has an off season and they may not hit the way they had.
I don't think. General output of the club was reduced. The club suffered.
Were you still PR man at that time, 1941?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Giles was still there. Frank Lane was still there.
I don't know whether Frank was still there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you weren't going to plan on staying club secretary and PR man all your life.
I wasn't planning on anything.
You weren't? You didn't say, hey, I want to be president of the Cincinnati Reds Ball Club?
No, I just went to work and did my job. And I was happy with what I was doing.
So just like, well, not many people get to say, hey, I enjoy what I'm doing, I love it, and I get paid for it.
That's right.
Well, evidently somebody saw something in you that says, hey, he's not going to be selling tickets and passing out press releases. Mm-hmm. Somebody saw some other potential in you.
Charles.
And what'd he do?
He always encouraged me. He was very good.
Okay, by the end of the 41 season, the war had broken out.
Mm-hmm.
That is, as far as America's role in it. What'd you do? I gather you were not drafted or anything.
I was in 43.
You were in 43.
Yeah.
So you stayed with the Cincinnati club until then.
I was offered a commission in early as 43. George Trotman was heading something, and he was heading the Mile Eight, and he offered me a commission. Mr. Giles said at that time, he said, they know your name and address. And he said, but did you look for them and get you? Mm-hmm. They came and got me.
They came and got you.
I was the first group of pre-Pearl Harbors, Harbor Fathers, that was drafted. I had two children. Mm-hmm. But I went in with fellows who had spent is 7 or 8. And the reason for that is I was about to move, and I gave the office address as my address. Mm-hmm. And that put me in a draft board with the Billboard Baggers team, where they had a lot of carnival pitchmen, and that our draft board had more the delinquents in the rest of the country combined. So if you were warm, you were in. So I was in there reading at the Bank Draft pre-Pearl Harbor Fathers. Huh. I was already in when I read about that.
So you came back with the Reds after World War II in 45.
Yeah.
And got out to be with them for most of the 1945 season.
No.
No?
No, it was after the season.
Okay, so 46 would have been your first full season.
Yeah.
Afterwards. And then your wife found out that there's more to baseball than winning the pennant and going to World Series as far as the Cincinnati Reds franchise.
I don't know, she found out, I did too.
Oh, okay. Yeah, both of you did.
Yeah.
What'd you come back as? PR man?
Tribal secretary and PR man. Okay.
Giles was still there. Mm-hmm. Frank Lane had, I think, probably gone over to the St. Louis organization.
He had the White Sox.
Oh, we went to White Sox? Okay. I remember he was a general manager of Columbus Redbirds in the American Association at one time. I don't remember the exact years, but anyway. I guess the traveling secretary then does about the same that a traveling secretary does in 1993?
Well, it did more. Yeah.
Then?
Yeah.
What was a typical day on the road then? Say you came up to the train station in Chicago, out of Cincinnati, beginning a three-game stand with the Cubs. What was a typical day in the life of Gabe Paul as a club secretary?
Well, he made all the travel arrangements and the arrangements to go to the park.
What, you mean a bus would pick up the players?
At that time, we didn't have buses.
Okay. So you had taxi cabs?
Taxi cabs.
Okay.
And took care of the free admissions.
The what kind of?
Free admissions for the...
For whom?
The players and their families.
Why would the players have to worry about paying admission to go play ball game?
Well, they took care of their families.
Oh, their families. So yeah. If the wives and children wanted to go, that they could... So the home club would allocate so many tickets per ball player.
Yeah.
2 or 3 or 4, whatever they wanted.
They usually gave you so many for the club.
Mm-hmm. So you kind of divvied them out to whoever needed them.
Yeah.
Well, you're a pretty popular guy.
Well,
or unpopular if he didn't have enough tickets.
I always felt that the player who came from a city had first right of to the tickets.
So if you had a ball player coming from Chicago, that was his hometown.
Yeah, he had the first right to the tickets. He had more requests than anybody else.
Okay, for aunts and uncles and what have
sure.
you.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Of course, in those days, wives did not travel with the husbands.
Very seldom.
Maybe the manager's wife, but that's probably about it.
Not very often, the manager's wife.
So, you handled arrangements for all the press interviews with ball players?
Most of them.
Dealt with the broadcasters in any way?
Mm-hmm.
That you got to the ballpark in time?
Mm-hmm.
That they met curfew? Were you the...
I had nothing to do with that. That was up to them.
So the...
Whether they met the curfew or not.
Okay. Well, if the manager thought, well, I think a couple of these guys are breaking curfew. What, he check the bellboy and find out who would come in after midnight and pay him $5 or something?
No. McCheckley never believed in doing business that way. If he wanted to catch somebody, he caught him.
He had his own way of doing it. Didn't have to hire anybody else.
He didn't believe in hiring people.
Mm-hmm. And he's usually right about the
ether. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've heard, Gabe, that in those days, ball players, you know, most of them didn't go to college. A lot of them probably never finished high school. Baseball is really a blue-collar sport. And a lot of them, because they had free time on their hands, they literally became alcoholics.
I wouldn't say so.
You wouldn't say so any more than today?
No. There were some bad boys, but there were some good boys, too.
Did any of them, like McCormick, some of the stars of the team, get overwhelmed by the fans that they felt like they were prisoners? They just stayed in their hotel room until ball game time, that they really couldn't get out on the street? I heard Joe DiMaggio felt that way in his last few years as a Yankee, that he couldn't even eat in privacy, that he would have meal brought up to his room.
I couldn't tell you about that, but I could tell you about McCormick. And McCormick was just like you or I. And he was very gracious and very humble.
Mm-hmm.
Same way as Bill Werber. And Lonnie Frye, and what do you call it? The Wallers.
After the war, Bill McKechnie retired in 1946. And Cincinnati really went downhill. They kind of hugged the bottom of the kind of 7th and 8th place there up until the mid-50s when Bertie Tebbets came on board. Yet you had some power hitters. You had Hank Sauer. You had Frankie Baumholtz. You know, there was pretty
Bob Mullins went to Chicago.
Yeah. So did Sauer, didn't he?
Yeah.
For Penis Laurie and Harry Walker. That wasn't a very good deal for the Reds.
No.
You still weren't there. Were you involved in that particular trade in any way?
I was there, but I was not involved in the trade.
Mm-hmm. I was just saying, if Giles was preparing you to then go up the ladder to take on other responsibilities, if he would sit down with you and say, here are the reasons why I'm going to trade these guys.
No.
He never did share those thoughts with you.
I would say so.
Oh, okay. But nevertheless, you still learned a great deal about baseball from him, and I guess his general philosophy.
Absolutely.
Well, there's one guy I do remember. He was pretty skinny, tall, and won 16 straight games in 1947.
Blackwell.
Yeah. Ewell Blackwell. With that old submarine pitch.
He was more sidearm.
Sidearm?
Yeah.
He came up through the farm system, didn't he?
Yeah.
And he put some excitement in the Cincinnati team by that kind of record.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then what happened, you know?
He had a kidney removed. He never... It was... They said it was congenital. It wasn't. He had a discharge, and they went in and spread the infection.